You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. If you haven't seen this movie, it's a great movie. It's called Ray. Jamie Foxx plays Ray Charles. I thought it was a great movie. Tim Lynch joins me from Texas. You seen the movie, Tim? Hello?
I said I had not seen that movie, buddy.
I would recommend it to you. Ray, check it out. Jeff Kenny joins me from San Clemente. Jeff, have you seen that movie?
I have not.
All right, well, then put it on your list for Christmas, all right, if you're ever looking for a decent movie. Ray Charles does not start out in his life blind. He's blinded. I can't remember what childhood disease he got, but he was struck blind by a disease, and then the rest of it is his story. But pretty interesting guy. So anyway, let me we're going to talk about the Afghanistan papers. And so I did a little thing yesterday about only the rubes and jabronis among us are surprised at this, in my opinion. And I played some stuff. One, I played a thing about the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg, and that during Vietnam. I talked about H.R. McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty. I kind of fast-forwarded to Desert Storm, The Perfect War, right? And then after that, you know, we go into two conflicts where the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff doesn't have a clear idea of Phase 4 when we're going to go to war, which we're not supposed to do. We have the Chief of Staff of the Army saying you're going to need several hundred thousand troops to garrison a pretty large nation that has three very, very separate cultural groups in there, and if you want to keep something bad from happening. He's then shown the door by Darth Vader himself, Don Rumsfeld, who then proceeds to pull a rabbit out of the hat. Not. You mean it's harder to flip a Middle East state than we thought it was? Who the fuck knew that? We expand the war in Afghanistan, and then we find out they're not telling the truth. Now, for those of us who worked in both places, you knew what you experienced on the ground, and then you watched the shit you'd see on TV and the shit that got said in public, and you knew they were telling the truth, right?
Yeah.
To include, from the very beginning in Al Anbar, we didn't have enough guys. And so it goes. So everybody shocked the Afghanistan paper. So I want to lay that as kind of the backdrop of all of this, and let me let Jeff have the floor and just talk about the Pentagon Papers of Vietnam, Jeff.
The Pentagon Papers from Vietnam was commissioned by McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense, and he wanted a comprehensive. How the hell do we get here? Secret history that, you know, is only going to be privy to certain people. How do we get to this? So it was from 1945 and to 1965 was the original, prerogative that they had to do this. And it was done by the RAND Corporation, which stands for nothing more than Research and Development Corporation. It's not like somebody's name or anything like that. And, so they had a bunch of smart guys on it, and they're starting to work. And one of them was a former Marine officer named Daniel Ellsberg.
What?
Who was appalled that, he was a Marine officer.
No shit.
Got to be a company commander, 57 to 59.
Who was?
Yeah. But he got out, and then he was bounced around a little bit. He's a very smart guy. I think he's a Harvard grad. Typical, if that means anything.
Typical Marine officer.
Yeah, most of the disasters in our history come from Harvard and Yale grads and stuff. But at any rate, he worked for a government. He worked for that RAND Corporation. He went to Vietnam, during the 64-65 time frame, and then later as a strategic analyst like John Paul Vann. As a matter of fact, he's good friends with John Paul Vann. They chased Vietnamese women together. That was another. He was not a egghead, is what I'm getting at. He's a smart guy, but he wasn't just that. He gets to work for the Pentagon doing this thing, and he's appalled at the flat-out lies what got us to commit ground troops in 1965.
So now, let me ask you a question. The flat-out lies, that's to be contrasted with flat-ass truth?
Yes.
Okay.
It comes out during the Pentagon Papers that we're complicit in the assassination and overthrow of President Ngo Diem, a Catholic guy who was president for most of the late 50s and up until 1963. Matter of fact, he was assassinated only weeks before JFK. And then there's two Gulf of Tonkin incidents involving North Vietnamese torpedo boats. One of them actually happened, but the second one was total fabrication. And that came out in this. So that people who had begun to suspect the Vietnam War, the efficacy of the thing, was giving them ammo. Now, remember, too, they started to put out the Pentagon Papers 68, 69. They started to develop the story, or not the story, but the narrative. Ellsberg, who had been in Vietnam several times, had actually been in a little bit of action. He's appalled at the thing. He starts deciding, I'm going to go ahead and expose this. Now, his time in Vietnam, he knew a journalist who was good friends with John Paul Vann, his other friend, named Neil Sheehan. And one of the two magnum opuses of Neil Sheehan in his life, one was A Bright and Shining Lie about John Paul Vann, but the first one was The Pentagon Papers. And so Ellsberg, due to the technology of the time, he starts sneaking. He's mimeographing and copying, you know, old. I'm talking 1968 technology, copying a couple sheets at a time, day by day, and it took him years to get them all done and to Sheehan. So the Pentagon Papers didn't come out till 71. When they did, they landed with a thud, in the whole government, and. Now you got to remember, 1971, people were pretty much fed up with Vietnam. And matter of fact, 71 was the last Marines were out of Vietnam by May of 71, and the Army was fast pulling out too. So it exercised President Nixon, and President Nixon doing his best to defend and to prevent these papers from coming out and to prosecute Daniel Ellsberg. And they actually had the same adventurers who did the Watergate break-in broke into the psychiatrist's office of Ellsberg, because Ellsberg was the type of guy who he thought, you know, my obsessions and my bad habits may be the result of mental problems. So he had a psychiatrist. Now I'd have a useless root canal before I, on my own, go to a psychiatrist. But, you know, I'm no Daniel Ellsberg. So Daniel Ellsberg they break in, they try and find out what kind of nut is this guy, and can we use it against him? And that got exposed. And when it did, they dropped all the charges against him. And by that time, now it's a year later, and now that we're in the throes of the smashing landslide victory of Nixon over McGovern, but almost immediately following that, it came out that Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt and a couple other yahoos, even though I like Gordon Liddy, had broke in and into the Democratic National headquarters there in Watergate Hotel in D.C. and did their silliness there. They did that thing I do understand why they did it, but that's a subject for another conversation. That's my thumbnail story of the Pentagon Papers. Now we go deep into. I mean, there is way more malfeasance that was exposed about Vietnam.
Okay, give us a 2-minute thumbnail of Dereliction of Duty for those that haven't read that.
Well, that's where the whole time this is going on, it's no secret to the Army dudes and the high-ranking Marine people, particularly the chairman of or the chief of staff of the Army, General Harold Johnson. He knew, he was the chief of staff of the Army.
Yep.
He knew all this, and he was in an agony that I should resign. I should do, because Napoleon, who is like, had written extensively on what does an officer do when his conscience won't let him, you know, cheerfully obey orders, like sacking Poland and stuff like that. What should an officer do? And he says the only honorable thing you can do is resign, because you've sworn an oath, so you have to resign. But then you can say why you resign. And so Johnson thought, maybe if I resign, people will take notice and change this thing, because soldiers and Marines and other servicemen were being killed at the rapid rate in Vietnam. Not to mention, you know, probably 2-3 times that number of South Vietnamese and North Vietnamese. So, but in the end, and this is my thumbnail, my read on it, him and a lot of others then and before then and up to now thought, oh no, I can do more good by working from within and being loyal, but yet at the same time trying to gently persuade my civilian superiors the right way, which of course means you got to lie, otherwise you get fired. And so that's what happened. And so years and years of lies from the get-go. Like, and then people thought, well, this will never happen again because of the stain. The military was scorned. The civilian leadership was scorned. Even though Richard Nixon zealously tried to prevent the Pentagon Papers from coming out, there was really nothing in there about him or anything he did. So it wasn't, you know, people like to really, they look at Richard Nixon kind of like the Shakespearean version of Richard the Third, crook fact, you know, like he's some kind of villain, villain. But
he did play the part.
Yeah, I mean, he's the type of guy who looked like he was lying even if he was telling the truth.
Oh, my God. And, you know, he was a short guy. I saw him at a baseball game after he was impeached. He used to come to the Angel game when my dad was a coach for the Angels. And he would show up in the second inning in this limousine, and he'd pull in behind the fence in left field, and he'd had this kind of secret route to go hang out with Gene Autry and sit in the shadows of his. And one day I had come from work, and I was late, and I get out of my car, and here's Tricky Dick. I was like, oh, shit. I'm like, whoa, thought you were a bigger dude than you are. What's up, little man? No, but he's not a big guy. But
that whole idea about I can do more working from within is kind of an egocentric way of looking at things. Like, I'm too valuable to let myself go just for a little thing like personal integrity and morals. You know, I need to stay here and keep plugging. And same thing happened, in my opinion, during the air quotes war on terror.
All right, let's Timmy. Any comments you want to make about Pentagon Papers or dereliction of duty?
Nope, not about those two. I'm saving my ammo for the issue at hand. Thank you.
Got it. All right. So then we go to the perfect war, which is Desert Storm, and it's kind of the culminating fruits of victory for the Vietnam era guys, because it was like, give us an objective, give us the tools, get everybody out of the way, and let us do it. And then, as General Zinni says, we had the only son of a bitch stupid enough to lay down on the sand exactly the way we've been rehearsing fighting him for 20 years. Right? And we blow the living shit out of that dude. It's the perfect war, and we come home, and it's awesome. Right? It's awesome. And we don't have a lot of casualties. We get other nations to pay for it. It's the perfect war in a bow. So now we can go do anything, okay? And so now comes Afghanistan and Iraq. And the more and more you look at it, Vietnam gets reenacted. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you avoid, you know, that theme that is so dominant and so reoccurrent throughout every different phase of whether it be mission creep, whether it be people not telling the truth, and now, you know,
enemy sanctuaries.
Right. And now these papers come out and say, oh my God, you know, people weren't telling the truth. And so, Timmy, you want to pick up the narrative? Talk about the Afghanistan papers now.
Well, the first thing I want to say about the Afghanistan papers is I was very happy to see them, because I was afraid, I never thought this to be the case, but I was afraid that maybe the senior people running this war were believing the bullshit that they were laying out for the last 18 years. Because nobody on the ground there in Afghanistan was confused as to what was happening. I don't believe Jeff was. I don't believe you were. And I sure as hell was not. So to me, the hard part is that our politicians will look at a chain of events and construct a narrative that makes sense and makes them look good and avoid responsibility after the fact, right? So we go rolling into Afghanistan. The thing falls a lot faster than we thought. It's kind of amazing. I don't know why we stayed and how this goes on, but then the narrative starts. And you and Jeff, you two guys, you're being sent to Afghanistan with forces tailored to support a narrative that you know is bullshit.
Yeah.
I can remember the first time General Nicholson said something about government in the box in regards to Marja to me. I didn't say anything back to him, but I told Killer and Mel. I'm like, hey guys, that's fucking insanity. That's not going to work. And so.
That's it right there.
The thing is what's most upsetting about this is when you see these ironically named snowflakes from Rumsfeld, who in 2003 is complaining about how the hell will I ever get out of here, when it was his damn job to define the conditions under which we would leave. That's the most upsetting thing about the Afghan papers. Other than that, I don't know anybody that's surprised who was paying attention to what was happening on the ground.
Well, let me just add one thing. I mean, Tommy Franks, right, and the successive chairman, right, who do this dance and won't do what Jeff said, which is, hey, look, I can't with good conscience execute this. But I want to talk about something. I think
Franks was CENTCOM. I'm sorry. He was he's directly responsible. You're absolutely right.
So you don't have a concept in your head, and you won't put your hand up and say, hey, I can't do this. You've got to give me more than this. And, oh, by the way, my friend, Eric Shinseki, who you just shit-canned, he's right. We are going to need 200 to 3,000 people in Iraq if we're going to stay there. Oh, and one other thing. When you look to expand the ground war, do you realize on the planet what you're attempting to do has never existed in that patch of geography on your Google Earth map? It's never been like that. And so if you want to do that, we're going to have to be here for a while. And as long as the American people know that, and as long as we're down for that, and as long as you'll supply the number of troops that it's going to take to do that, then okay, I got it, we'll go. But if you can't or won't do those things, then you can't do this. It's immoral to ask people to go die and then say, oh, fuck, I didn't realize it was going to take us 60 years to do this shit.
You know, I'd say in regards to Afghanistan, a blessing that gave the outcome hope in the beginning of our involvement in Afghanistan was the fact that it was obvious that the National Command Authority was more interested in going into Iraq. And so consequently, a lot of CENTCOM's, Maverick, most of CENTCOM's attention from early 2002 and maybe even late 2001 was, we got to go here and do this. And because when they really started paying attention to Afghanistan, that's when the mistakes really started happening.
Well, they weren't paying attention.
They decided they were going to have a strong central government that they were going to set up. And they're going to use this guy, Karzai, who was a Pashtun, who was highly educated and spoke good English. He was going to be the head of the central government. And the way that government was designed, the parliament and were very weak, and the president was very strong. He chose all the district governors. He chose the provincial governors, but he also chose the district governors. So in other words, it's like he's picking not only the state governors, but he's picking the mayors.
And why was he allowed to do that? Hold on, man. This is even worse. Why was he allowed to do that? Because our friggin' ambassador, Calazide, put in place this single non-transferable voting mechanism which made it impossible to have political parties. And we allowed Karzai to do that ridiculous shit. Because I tell you, I'll finish up when you get done, Jeff. I'm sorry to interrupt.
I know how you feel, and I feel the same way, because you almost choke on your rage.
Well, hold on. Let me just say one thing. Did you see Karzai's quote in yesterday's paper?
No, it
was American money that fueled this corruption. Oh,
well, he's right.
Bullshit. That corrupt system existed. We just dumped more money on it and became more corrupt. It wasn't like we invented corruption.
No, we didn't invent corruption. No, you're right. They're masters at it. But we did provide a vehicle.
Right.
And that vehicle was that government. And then we compounded that by deciding, okay, we need an army that looks like our army, that has colonels and generals and schools. And so who do we use to command this thing? Two groups. One, former Muj guys who fought the Russians. Fair enough.
Right.
Two, former Afghan traitors who were working for the Russians the whole time. These two groups were going to run the Afghan army. And the one thing they agreed on was to steal as much as they could. I used to think that the Bismillah Rahman Rahim, which means Allah bless these proceedings, which they say at every meeting at the beginning. I'm sure you guys heard that. I used to think it really means Allah give me fingers where my toes are so I can steal with four hands. Because the way they saw it, we were transitory, like everyone else had been. Mm-hmm. And we were going to lose. But while we were there, you got to get while the getting's good. And so, consequently, they made the army up to be anything but effective. Every unit, really the war is against people in the Pashtun areas, at least during the beginning, because that's where the Taliban seed corn was. They use this. They send these army units in there, pretty much the way the Russians went in, or the way we would go in with conventional forces. Only thing is, they even had less of a preclusion to do counterinsurgency. It was awful. I mean, any success we had was due to the neglect of our national command authority in the beginning. And once they started paying attention to it in 2009, they made it even worse. And when you and I were talking, Mac, I said, the money we poured in there dwarfs what we put in to the Marshall Plan. I'm right, but I'm also wrong, because the Marshall Plan doesn't count all the money we spent building all the militaries up of the people in Europe. And then not giving them a constraint to use it when we want them to. So if we're not really experts at anything other than wasting our own resources
and fucking it up.
That's what I'm saying. Wasting the zeal of our youth, who, when attacked, everybody from pro football players to egg-headed college students was doing like what we did after Pearl Harbor, and unlike what happened after Pearl Harbor, it was wasted. Wasted for a lot, and a lot of reasons had nothing to do with the actual success on the ground. We decided it would be a great idea. Matter of fact, General Jones, who was UCOM, after the first guy to ever get a job after he was commandant, still wearing a uniform, they decided it would be a great idea to put NATO in there. It was an awful idea to put NATO in there. Now you got all these countries who want to get in there, who want to get the dime, who want to get that money. But they got all these caveats. So the French guys can do things that the Italians won't, and the Italians won't do things that the Germans will, and the only people you can count on is a good old U.S. Army and Marine Corps.
Yeah, they do windows. Everybody else, right, I want my combat pay, and I want this, and I want that, but we're not going to sustain any casualties, okay?
And then lying. I mean, here's an example. The FET teams, these female engagement teams. When I went for Meyer's Medal of Honor ceremony in 2011, here's General Amos and his Sergeant Major, what was his name? You guys know, the guy, big tall guy, Bowen or something like that. I'm wrong. That's not his name. But anyway, they're both, I see him in the White House. Sir, I'm Jeff Kennedy, Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Kennedy. Yeah, Jeff, what do you think about these FET teams in there? Doing pretty good, huh? And I thought, sir, they suck. I mean, first of all, the Afghans don't tell their women anything. And number two, the FET teams are just a burden for the ground units there. Every battalion commander in there will tell you that. Well, what's not what the regimental commanders are telling me? And I'm like, well, I don't know what to say, sir.
Hey, look, I want to add something in, and that is the futility of me wasn't always evident. It took me a long time to understand what was happening in Afghanistan. And that's point number one. In order to have any kind of a chance at a clue as to what the hell's happening around you, you kind of need to be there a while. And because I didn't understand what was how to operate for 3 or 4 years it took me. But there were times when we could have done when we could have achieved our objectives. Our problem was too much money and too many people thrown at yeah. things. Whereas when you guys locked down the Helmand. I knew that was going to happen. I could drive from Lashkar to Khan Shin without any problems whatsoever. Never been able to do that before since. But the second you left, those gains were gone. Those gains were transitory.
Yeah, but you know, Timmy, let me just make a mistake. Let me just make a comment. You know, I mean, who in their right mind could have predicted that if we had enough Marines in there, right, and after we kicked their ass, that it would all cool out? And who in their right mind would have predicted when we withdrew that it would go the other way? Who in their right mind could have seen something so fucking low hanging and ripe, right? That any fucking moron would know that. That if you're going to attempt to do this, you got to have enough ass to do it. And if you don't, it's immoral to go do it.
It is, but the one thing was I wanted to point out was particularly the governor down there in Khanishin, and the one in Nawa wasn't bad. There were Afghans out there who worked with us who, honest to God, were all about the Afghan people and not pocketing their pay. There were Afghan guys, like crooked politicians, who at least were reasonable about what they're pocketing and still saw most of it go to the people. The mayor of Afghanistan is one of those. But
the mayor of what?
The mayor of Jalalabad. Mm-hmm. The mayor of Jalalabad. Is one of those guys. He's a little bit of a thief, but not bad. The people loved him, right?
Yeah, but I mean, come on, a little bit of a thief in the context of a culture shares money like that. That's not.
Oh yeah, that's an honorable man. What I'm saying is that as those effective guys were identified with you and that Carter Malishin guy down there at Khanishin, when that guy became effective, what did Karzai do? What did the governors do? They friggin' removed those people immediately and put in their guys. Because what they didn't want was effective leadership down at the district level.
There's a lot of Afghan leaders who are pretty good. It's not the whole thing, but they're beyond the tipping point to where, you know, those guys are, if they come up on the net, like Timmy said, they're gone. And by coming up the net, I mean show how that they're being effective.
By
the guy that Paul was partnered with, General Wassey, up there in the north, that guy was effective. Now, I'm not saying he's a sweetie pie. I'm not saying he's 100% honest. But he was effective. And, he just – when I was in there last time, he was way out west by Herat.
Right.
But, you know, what I'm saying is they weren't – you really had to be careful. Those guys had to be careful. It was the way we were doing it was – unwinnable. And here's the thing. I'm not one of these guys who believes there's such a thing as an unwinnable war. That's just ridiculous. Of course you can win a war. You just got to make more right moves than wrong moves. It's really not any more complicated. It's hard, but it's not really that common. This is an unwinnable war. You can't kill your way out of this war. All this bullshit you hear from mostly civilians, although some military people say that shit too. What's unwinnable is if you pursue a strategy that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And I have to tell you, when you're fighting a counterinsurgency, particularly a counterinsurgency that isn't bordered by, like in Vietnam, you had the borders there where there were pretty much, there was conventional troops coming in and fighting a conventional war in large parts of the north and the western part of South Vietnam. But there... In Afghanistan, you don't have that. There's not huge numbers of guys streaming across the borders and stuff like that. So I think the way to do this thing was to you get your Afghan military and you use it in accordance with its capabilities, in accordance with what's more natural for them to do. And you let them engage. And when they start getting their ass kicked, and they might, then our guys come in and win for them or come in and if nothing else, you know, become experts at the counterattack. That's when, and then we pull back to places that are relatively, you know, not engaged. Let them be the face of the people, because if you try and be, you know, the counterinsurgency force, you're always going to fail. Nobody wants somebody from another country telling them what's what.
But let me ask you this. So as we look back at, we go and we romp around and we chase Osama bin Laden and we don't get him and all the rest of that nonsense, right? And then after that, we look at this. Why would we even go down this road?
Right.
I mean, look, if you look at history, right, you look what happened to the Russians. We're that arrogant that we think that we're going to, you know, so let's talk about if we're going to do it, how many people is it going to take us in how many years? And you have that discussion for 30 minutes and the right conclusion is fuck this. Let's get out of here. We can't go down this road. We'll be here forever.
Now, this is the question, though, because I don't know about Afghanistan and how that happened. I know we run them out in 2001. Starting in 2002, we start deploying special forces teams to places like Lashkar and whatnot, and they announce that they want to round up Al-Qaeda, right? And they're going to pay bounties. So I can't speak for the rest of the country, but down there in Helmand, the local Afghan police who are cooperating with us, who were probably Taliban to begin with, they start policing up orphan boys off the street, saying, here they are right here. We sent orphans, I shit you not, to Gitmo because we thought they were Taliban. They're Afghan people. Were laughing at us. Then, as we still got just special forces teams out there looking for Taliban, quote, right, then they start playing us off against their business rivals. And somewhere in 2003, 2004, we start sending in more and more and more goddamn people with no idea. I remember running into Andy McManus in Jalalabad. This is right before that lone survivor thing. And I said, hey, man, what? I was trying to mooch some ammo off him because we were hurting for training ammo at the embassy, which was, of course, not that the embassy was going to give me shit. But I'm like, what's up? He's going, I've got this op that's going to go, and the SEALs are going to do the recon. They're going to fuck it up. This is just ridiculous. But once I've done this, I'm gone. I said, well, what's Kuno like? He goes, it's nothing. There's just some criminals out there, no big deal. Right, but then all of a sudden, Karzai and the UN had this big conniption fit about losing the trees in Kunar, and we set up a goddamn base in the only friggin' place where you can process logs for the loggers in Kunar, because
exactly
Karzai
right.
wasn't getting his cut. I know, Jeff. I feel like I'm at a revival with you. Amen, brother. And this is the kind of shit that I was sitting there. That's why I started writing the blog. I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Right.
We talked about this shit in the 90s, and this is not what we said we were going to do. I remember that well.
The war in Korngal had nothing to do with Allah or Islam. It was all about that timber. How many
guys got whacked because
of that?
That's exactly what it was. It was all about that. And the one in Nuristan was about Karzai stuffing ballots. Oh, no, you've got... Oh. What the hell was that, Jeff?
It was Barja Mattal.
Barja Mattal, exactly.
Okay, hold on. Hey, Timmy, hold on. Let Jeff talk.
Well, Tim did a great job of laying out what happened in the Korngal. It's good that he brought up what happened in Barja Mattal, because it lends to the corruption, which we ended up not only acquiescing, but enabling and aiding. Let's talk about the election of 2009. Total fraud. The guy who won was Abdullah Abdullah, but the guy who stayed president was Karzai. We flew like 23,000 ballots up to Barja Mattal, and this is after, you know, we're fighting for the place and basically fighting over who has the rights to smuggle diamonds and other precious stones out of there, because that's what was up there. We flew 23,000 ballots up there. There wasn't even 23 people up there. But they all voted for all those 23,000 votes that were flown up in CH-47s. All of them went for Karzai. And we lost, I don't know, 15, 25 army troops up there, and God knows how many Afghans trying to hold Barja Mattal against the HIG and against the Taliban. And the only reason they were pissed at us up there is because they were basically interfering with the gem trade, the illegal gem trade. Am I right, Timmy?
You're absolutely right. That's exactly what goes through there. It's the same reason why in the Korngal, they were pissed at you about putting what the hell was that base you guys put in the sawmill?
There was the cop Cornwall, but then we were down in the little town there. I can't remember the name of it, right near. It had nothing. Like I say, it wasn't a. And here's the thing about the Cornwall, the people. Asadabad is the capital of Kunar province. It's like 6 miles away from Cap Cornwall. They don't speak. They can't talk to each other. They speak a whole different language up there. It's like the man who would be king part two, you know?
And, all right, so let me stop this and let's go back to the original premise. So, and we can go to Iraq first and then come back to Afghanistan. Anybody who was in Iraq, right? You went there, you knew the issues, you watched the TV, right? And you saw the bullshit that got said. Anybody shocked at the people, anybody who was there shocked to read, right, you know, or hear that the truth didn't get told to the American people? Jeff?
No. I mean, I wasn't shocked. I was sick to my stomach, though. I thought, this whole thing is not, there's no way we can succeed if we refuse to see this obvious thing. Is like, to me, even more than Afghanistan, we didn't have enough guys in Iraq. From 2003 until 2007, we were woefully, we the strongest nation on earth, with 1.6 million people in uniform, we chose to hang our guys' asses out there, and we took way more casualties than we needed to, because of that.
So anybody who served there, the conclusion was unmistakable, right? We played whack-a-mole. The most powerful nation on the planet, because of our Secretary of Defense and his vision of the world, him tearing up the war plan, right, and pulling his own out of his ass that had to do with special people zooming around, and that's all we really needed to control this country, and then we had to have some firm bases around the but that's all we needed. That guy unleashed what you see today in Iraq, in the region.
I always hate that, that guy. Always hate that.
But for those of us who were there, we watched. We knew the truth, and then we waited for somebody. Like, why won't somebody walk back there and say we don't have enough fucking guys, right?
Yeah. When I was in the hospital, General Hagee's going from rack to rack, and what do you think, there, Marine? Sir, we need more guys. Or Lance Corporal, Lieutenant. Sir, we need more guys. Sir, you know. They kiss to me, and I'm like, sir, we need more guys. Yeah, we need more guys. Well, I mean, if there's more guys, there'll be more casualties, because there'll be, like, as if you're in a rainstorm. The more guys are in the rain, the more guys get wet. It doesn't work.
No, you don't understand. They understand. When there's a lot of us, they don't fuck around.
That's exactly right.
Oh, my God.
When I became an advisor, for the sole purpose of getting Afghans to run over IEDs that I saw Marines running over, but then the only way you get them out to do is to set the example. So I ended up running over an IED, you know? And that's how I met General Hagee. Otherwise, I never would have met the Commandant.
Well, there you go.
So there's a bright side to everything.
The upside to running over an IED.
I met General Hagee and Sergeant Major whatever his name
was. So what happens? What happens to leaders in our services? I mean, so they become politicians too?
Yeah, they're afraid. Well,
it's not just them. It's not just them. The narrative, the narrative is coming out from the White House, and guess who's absolutely playing along with the narrative? Because the only way the press, you covered this the other day, Mac, the only way the press got any access to the battlefield was via the freaking public affairs officer. There was none of this running around the battlefield like in Vietnam, unless you were a blogger, right? And so everybody was complicit in this, to include the goddamn Washington Post.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, they went over there and covered it, you know.
Look at it this way, Mac. Okay, Rolling Stones goes over there in 2010? And what's their great, revelation they come out with? That McChrystal's staff made fun of the vice president and didn't like the president.
So wait, we're talking about Afghanistan now?
Yeah. I'm just saying that the press is the press.
Right.
You know, they don't. There's no difference in the press between Iraq and Afghanistan or Vietnam. You know, they're there.
Again, I don't like. Are they going to tell the truth? I mean, they go over there with the story already written. They go over there to take pictures with whoever they can take pictures with.
Exactly.
Right. And then they do that so they can write it. Big headline and ask for a raise and go on a bunch of talk shows. That's what they do. That's how it's done. There were some guys, though. Michael Gordon, in my opinion, was one of them. You read his shit and you were there and you said, I don't know who that dude is, but that guy knows what the fuck's going on.
There is some guys.
Right,
I'll
like
tell you, I know another one. I can't remember his name. You'll probably mention it in a little bit, though.
But to me, they don't have a moral obligation to the truth. And that's the part of all of this that bothers me, is that we have people that have sworn an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, and they served with us. They led us in those countries, and they didn't come back and do that, right? And so if they said, well, I did it on the down low, okay, and if they and then when they ignored you, did you not have a moral obligation, given the fact that there's lance corporals, PFCs, second lieutenants, first lieutenants, staff sergeants, sergeants, and all kinds of people over there getting whacked, getting their bodies blown to shit? Don't you have a moral obligation to put your hand up? And that's when we go back to Vietnam and cue the audio, Jeff Kenney saying, well, you know, I could have my 15 seconds of fame, and then the same thing's going to happen. I can do more good from inside the institution.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, too.
And that's a politician statement.
That's not exactly
a general officer statement.
Actually, generals usually say stuff like that since they were general. It's the other guy that's unusual. All those guys that won World War II, most of them are just like that. You had a couple, and thank God we had them, who weren't like that, and they're the race horses, you know. But most guys are not like General Slim or General Patton, you know, or somebody like that, or General Eckelberger, another good guy. You know, most of them are like Courtney Hodges, Omar Bradley. They're crushingly mediocre guys, and they're just there to get the next step up. Just like the guys in the gray flannel suit who work in, you know, Wall Street, and just like the guys who are working in the, you know, in oil companies and stuff like that. That's human nature, I think.
Yeah. I gotta agree with Jeff, but my question, guys...
No, let me tell you. What he just said is a statement of fact. We want to believe. We want... But if you look at... I mean, the striking similarity between the twin wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam relative to the culpability of the Joint Chiefs, relative to people who didn't tell the truth, relative to people that were more interested in their career than looking at Don Rumsfeld and saying, this is fucking crazy. We can't do this. Right? I mean, you read it, and to me, in my opinion, it's even more vile than Vietnam, because we should have learned from Vietnam. Right, those guys were still the fuck around, and Colin Powell was one of them, and he didn't do the right thing. And so, to me, it's really discouraging. And every one of these disasters we've gone into, we've been escorted by the general officers and the flag officers of the United States military.
Yeah, and it's like they don't even. And I remember when I was in Iraq as an advisor. Because they were so interested in making sure that everybody got the absolute most you could out of your career opportunities in this combat situation, they had, if you remember, Mac, they had the flattened staff, where you had one general who's in charge, then you had a ground guy. So we had General Zilmer was in charge when I was there, and then General Neller was the ground guy. I can't remember who the air guy was. And General Reist, Brigadier General Reist, was the the civil affairs guy, you know, or basically our relations with the Afghan or the Iraqi security forces. I remember General Neller, I think he even then thought, this isn't worth it. There's no chance to win. So he put shit on us that would just keep as many of us alive as possible, which was disastrous for any kind of combat effectiveness. for the advisors and stuff like that. You had to, in order to get people to win, you got to put your ass on the line. If you want to be decisive, you got to take risk. And he thought risk isn't worth it, because even if you die and succeed, who cares? You know, I mean, that's the impression I got. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably being unfair to the guy, or it might have just been
not.
He couldn't stand to see one more guy get hurt. You know, but.
No, but Jeff, you're absolutely right. You were there to train the Afghans so that they could take care of their own security. And what do we know as the fundamentals of combat leadership training? Is it that you, the guy that's demanding the behavior, you demonstrate the behavior,
yes,
and take the same risk as everybody else? That's how we were raised. And to see those guys in those unarmored trucks surrounded by Humvees, me and my buddy Shem used to joke that it was just a matter of time before those MRAPs stopped, and just a probe came out, and they started like with engaging in dialogue from behind a grass screen or something.
Yeah.
Because
it was
the original version of the
joke. Pretty soon we'd all be in the EOD suit, and you'd open up a little slot where your mouth is and say, "I really trust you, brother. Glad to fight with you." And me, all this guy's wearing pajamas, you know, with a tin pot for a breastplate, you know, for his TV.
So let me ask you this. So are we too cynical? Because what we're saying is, you know, oh hum, the Afghan papers, really? You didn't know that shit? That you hadn't figured out that you've been lied to for all these years? Are we too cynical about it?
But I don't know if it's even that.
But I just want to put this in, because this is the issue in my mind. You know, right now we've got we're in competition for a president. We've got a lot of progressive people who are competing for the president, and that rests on the proposition that advancements in technology and science and social organization would allow man acting through the state to control destiny. That's why we built cabrilly green housing areas. That's why we did a lot of things. But the narrative that we have competent organizations that are worthy of our trust and confidence, they're not. It's destroyed. Every great institution is justified by a story, and the story of our institutions are they're self-serving, self-dealing, they suck, and they don't operate in reality. They know reality because you can see on the back channel communications they're seeing reality. But what they express to us is not reality, and that consequently means that you guys are going over there manned for a fictitious mission that everybody who sent you over there knows is not going to make a damn bit of difference. It's the damage to our institutions that are being
Well, let me just tell you this
stuff.
To me. I believe that's the way it's always been. And to me, the bulwark against that are your general officers. And if your general officers won't tell the truth, and what Jeff said is this has been the crisis throughout history, that they don't. That the most of them are mediocre people who know how to follow the rules. That's how they become generals, right? They're not pissing people off. They know how to swim down the stream, and they're not going to put their hand up and say this is wrong. We shouldn't do it, right? And they're not going to do it. So to me, asking politicians to tell the truth, who's the fool? They don't tell the truth. They tell you, as you just said. They tell you what they need to tell you to make themselves look good, to sustain their own personal empire.
Yeah,
that is like, what politicians do.
What we're coming to now, though, as we talk about this, because we're getting, and rightfully so, we're going from military to, we're talking leadership, military to politics. Because we crave liberty, or we like to think, but a lot of people in America just crave security. But when your livelihood depends on you being voted for, you're going to do that. A large percentage of your politicians are only going to say what's going to get them elected. Particularly when there's a back channel like Tim was talking about. We got our back channel. They have a back channel that says, hey, look, once you get in here, it's great being a congressman. You're like there's congressmen, there's senators, and there's presidents and vice presidents. That's it. And once you get to be one of these, you got a golden ass for the rest of your life as long as you don't screw it up. And how you can screw it up is by doing something wrong. And what does doing something wrong mean? I don't know. but I know I know what the doing something part is. So if we just don't do anything, we will be secure, and we will have wealth and comfort. And so they don't take those chances, and they get in there, and nothing happens, and they make deals with people on the other side of the aisle, if that exists.
To sustain their own political realm. And so this is where, to me, this thing comes back to, is the central role of the general officer and the flag officer to stop this shit. They have sworn an oath to the nation. They have a moral obligation to the nation to tell the truth and make sure the right things happen, and that this country does not go down roads that it should not go. And in my opinion, that's the failing that we rely on them, and they fail.
Let me ask you a question, though. When you're a four star, right? You're working for Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld sending you his little snowflake. How ironic is that he named him that? A snowflake saying, "Help! I don't know how I'm going to get out of Afghanistan." It's his job to tell you to lay out the metrics that are going to allow you to get out of Afghanistan. So it's not just the generals. You know, we've got this system. And this is what my frustration with the CIA and the State Department and those other guys who play in these big, gigantic exercises. They're supposed to participate as if they're taking it seriously. They never do. They never do. It's always Marine captains and majors doing all the damn work on those exercises. And when it comes to real-world scenarios, all of a sudden, the guy that's supposed to dictate to you the terms of what success is or isn't, he's sending you little snarky notes asking you why you don't know what the hell's going on.
Bingo.
What are the generals doing?
Okay, so what should they do, Timmy? Just go along with it.
You actually brought up something, Matt.
Well, I would like to think that they would band together and present a united front and say, "Hey, this is bullshit. We're not doing this." But it doesn't appear to me like they talk to each other much. So I don't know what they can do.
Yeah, it's like this, though. You know, when we are officers, and our main job in the beginning of our career as company officers is to use the weapon systems that we have as infantry to their max capacity. And that's why we have final protective lines, you know, with our machine guns and principal direction of fire with other weapon systems, and a final protective fires for the defense, and why we plan fires the way we do. Because we're trying to use our weapons and our men in accordance with their capabilities, because that's how you succeed. What we need, but the national command authority, the people making these decisions, need to know, and whether by accident or by design, President George H.W. Bush did it in the Desert Shield, Desert Storm thing. You need to politically shape the ground that your people are going to go on to give them the best possible chance for success. And going into a counterinsurgency with a bunch of folks who've been trained to basically do another version of, of the counterattack from in the Ardennes or the seizure of Saipan is not using them that way. And that's what happened in both Afghanistan and Iraq. We're not being used. We were used thoughtlessly. Say, "Oh, that's their job to know how to do it." Yeah, but it's your job to put us in a place where we can do what we do.
But they're politicians, and they don't know what the fuck they're doing. And so whose responsibility is it to look at them and say, "I can't sign up for that"?
Let me ask you this. What would happen if George Marshall or Admiral King were faced with Rumsfeld? Would they get fired?
Well, Shinseki did.
Yeah, Shinseki ain't no George Marshall.
Yeah, I don't think Marshall would have tolerated that bullshit for a second. I know he wouldn't. Marshall was at one of those meetings with Churchill, and Churchill was all set to invade some goddamn island off of Italy. This is before they went into Sicily,
right.
And they were arguing, and finally Marshall looked at Churchill and said, "Not one fucking American soul," or he said, "Goddamn. Not one goddamn American soldier is dying on that island." And that was the end of the discussion. The entire discussion moved to Sicily, Palermo, and D-Day. That's what kind of guy Marshall was.
And I know.
I don't know if there's one around.
Point of interest. Point of interest. That's true. And what came out of that was them dumping that that dead body of that British
That's right.
The man who never was, that made him think we were going into Greece.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, but again, I guess my frustration is I don't expect shit from politicians. You know, Jeff and I were talking last night. You know, if you looked into the number of congressmen, representatives, and senators, right, that went down and read the classified intelligence assessment, it was minuscule. So how did they decide whether we would go to war? You know, I'll tell you how they decided. How's it polling in the district?
Absolutely.
Oh, it's 70-30. There we go. Next issue. What else is going on in the district? And that's as far as they go. And I don't expect anything more from politicians. They are what they are. But I do expect more from the people who put their hand on a Bible, right, who swear an oath to defend this nation and the Constitution. Right, that they should care more about the country and the people they lead than their next promotion.
Well, I mean, go through that oath. What does it end up with? It says, I obey all orders from the officers appointed over me and the President of the United States. And so that's how they get away with that.
Right.
I mean, that's how they, because the oath says, you got to do what they say. And so I think a lot of guys, a lot of Marine officers, some of them who've been as high as the Joint Chiefs of Staff, say to themselves, I tactfully state my position. If the guy listens to me, he doesn't. If he says we're going another way, then I faithfully try and execute his fucked up order. You know, I think that's what they would say, Matt. You know, I think they should have a zeal to do what's right and what's least expensive.
And so look at this. Look what we've done to the Middle East. Look what we as Americans have fucking laid on those people, right? Look at the innocent people who were just living their lives in all their mud huts and all that. Look at the devastation that we've laid on those people. For what?
Well, who are you talking about?
Let's talk about Iraq, all right?
Okay. Look, I got no sympathy.
Right, well, I'm not asking for sympathy, okay?
But we're better than the guy before us. Not that that I agree with you.
The guy before us didn't kill as many people as we've killed.
Oh, I beg to differ. Killed more Iraqis, I bet.
Well, look, broaden the lens, my friend. Broaden the lens. And so that's what we've done on this fiat from the neocons. And you had guys like General Newbold and in uniform, and General Zinni and General Glenn Riper outside of uniform. Right, they were the ones that were telling the truth. I just think that if you look at the whole equation, the general officers have a special role to prevent these things, and they failed miserably over the course of the last 20 years. In my opinion, they failed across the board, and they've hurt the nation because of it, and they've hurt different regions of the world. And I think that the United States is too special of a nation to fuck it up this bad. And it compromises our ability to lead, and there is nobody else out there that can lead like the United States does. And so,
you know, but Matt, after Vietnam, what did we do to prevent getting used in such a sore manner in the future after Vietnam?
And the passive war powers.
If I'm not mistaken, it was moving a lot of combat service support units into the reserves, and particularly with the Army, having a three-division a Marine Corps that's forward deployed along with the air assets back up. And the thought was, as it was articulated to us in the 1980s, that the President will never again be able to send us to war without calling up the reserves. But what we didn't count on was, now that there's no red draft, nobody gives a shit about the reserves anymore. So it did not work out the way that we thought it would post-Vietnam. We deployed reservists willy-nilly all over the place, poorly trained, absolute cannon fodder in some cases. In some cases, they were very good. I mean, don't get me wrong. But what we did last time to prevent it this time Is it working? And how do you extract the lessons learned to do it right when the narrative is so jumbled up with the official narrative? And I'll tell you something interesting, because we've been dumping on generals. I got to say something about General Allen that's complimentary. As you guys know, I was in Afghanistan for a long, long time, as did General Allen, because he read my blog. And I spent an afternoon in Tampa before he went over to take over Afghanistan. General Mattis was a CO there, and Allen spent, I don't know, 5 hours talking to me, not about the military situation, because I knew nothing about that. He wanted to know what the people thought. He wanted to know how I moved around. He wanted to know my assessment of politicians. He wanted to know what the word was. He wanted to know what I thought. He was probing and asking questions that showed a certain amount of seriousness as he was going to take this on, because the inputs I gave him were unavailable to him through official channels. And thus, you know, I was able to do my little bit to try to influence things. But it wasn't like the general, like General Allen. He's no dummy. He knew what he was getting into, but they're working against the narrative that they've got to produce results for. All Allen was doing was trying to get people the hell out of there, if you'll remember. That was exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that he at least came and asked somebody for a different view that he wasn't going to get through official channels, and I appreciated that. It made me feel special.
He was doing a smart thing.
Yeah, he's doing the right thing, but it didn't make any difference to what he could do, what he thought he wanted to do, and what he could do. I mean, I don't know, but they have to be two different things. Because I was not very optimistic in my assessments, and I think I was right on with some of my comments about the politicians. I mean, I've been there a long time. You know,
I mean, the things that happen in history and the things that happen in technology shape the way the military, you know, is constructed. And the whole idea when those bombs went off in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then as you know, the nuclear technology proliferated and stuff, you had to have a standing force ready to react, but only react so far so you didn't trigger the doomsday thing. And so, we try to harken back to those times when we had guys like, the South had William Bedford Forrest, and we had guys like, Ulysses S. Grant, who'd come out of being a hardware store failure, to being a great general that he was. You know, it's like we can't depend on that anymore, because we just can't depend on the time. When the technology allows 19 Yahoos with box cutters to kill 3,000 people, and the fact that the implications of that are the sky's the limit. There's all kind of ways you can murder innocent people, and so now we got to lurch forward into this thing, with what we got. But people are there's always people thinking, particularly people in bureaucracies. Okay, this cataclysmic thing has happened. The nation is energized. We're lurching towards mass violence. That means that is an opportunity for more bureaucracy, for more taxpayer, donated wealth for people who just work for the government. I mean, the first thing that happened after 9/11 was this stupid Department of Homeland Security and other bureaucracy over bureaucracy.
Yeah, but that will always happen. That is the nature. That is the nature of politician. What exempts general officers from doing the right thing?
Well, I know, and
I would just tell you this: for everybody who's shocked about the Afghan papers and all the rest of that bullshit, okay. Let me just give you some safe assumptions to make in the future. One, general officers will not tell you the truth. Two, politicians will never tell you the truth. Right? And so when you go down this road to conflict, if it isn't ended quickly with overwhelming force and you get hung up there, it will be fucked up. And it will perpetuate itself.
So what's the answer then? I mean, you keep asking, general officers, guys, how do we get this? What zoo do we go to? What egg farm do we go to get that special guy that will do that? I mean, it's all that those things are related to a person's moral fiber, a person's upbringing, and everything like that. A person's experience in his military service. How do we shape a person to tell the truth? Here's a good way of doing it. Let's bring let's say we're going to let women do the same thing that only men have been doing for the, well, for all of recorded history, because the arduousness of it and the fact that it breaks a person down. Let's just say that that's no longer applicable. They, too, can do it. Now, every thinking man and most thinking women, I shouldn't say every thinking man or most, but knows that that's absurd. Yet we all say, yeah, well, if that's what the president says, if that's what the national, we're going to do it. So once you start lying about that stuff, lying to yourself maybe even, it's easy to lie about everything else. How can you expect somebody to do the right thing when the bullets are flying, when they don't even have the guts to do the right thing, when they're not, when it just means a promotion or, you know, or a raise or something like that? That's where we're at. We're in the land of a big. We're in the land of the your paycheck is at risk.
Right. I think that that's what I just said. That they won't do the right thing. So this whole false narrative of that we're going to go there and we're going to do the right thing for the right reasons and our generals, officers, right? They have, you know, that they can come back and lecture us about the morals of pissing on people when they won't stand up and do the right thing. It's all. Assume that all those wrong things are going to happen. And if you assume all those wrong things are going to happen, I think you'll be closer to the target than if you believe that what is being said out of Washington, D.C. by both elected leaders and general officers is true and valid. I think you'll be closer to the mark.
And here's the answer. I mean, or not an answer, but it's vital that we have somebody in this fifth or the fourth estate who has integrity. We need guys.
There
like,
you go.
But that's hard.
Right.
Because they're under the same or not the same but similar pressures. You know, about to not be that way. You know, what I mean, it's like it's a disturbing thing.
No, I to me it's the most disturbing thing, and because you know, I mean, for those of you who don't know. We're believers, right? We're jihadists.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be so exercised about this.
Right. We believe, right? I mean, you know, if you want to know who the true jihadists are, you're listening to three of them right now.
Yeah.
Right? Because we're the rubes that will go do it, right, on multiple occasions. And so we believe in our country. We believe in the things that we were raised on. And then when you find out that it's not everybody is pulling the oar that they should pull, then it's demoralizing isn't the right word.
You keep going back again and again.
Right.
And try to get it right the next time or righter the next time. Try not to make the same fuck ups, but then other fuck ups happen. It's a I hear you. You're actually right. We're the American jihadists.
No, and we'll go every time we're asked. There's no question. We'll volunteer. But in my honest opinion, Afghanistan did not have to end this way.
Right.
And I think the critical mistake we made was too many people, too many boots on the ground, and way too much money.
Timmy, I don't know, man. Let me just tell you this. If we sit down and we're going to OPT this, and we look at the end state, and we look at how do we get there, I think you quickly come to the conclusion that, you know what, boys? The juice will not be worth the squeeze in the end.
Well, that's what Timmy's saying. I'll tell you right, Mac. That shit in Helmand, it wasn't necessary for the Brits to go in there, and it wasn't necessary for us to go in there after it. That was stupid.
No.
There is no big war thing there. There's nothing there.
No.
We brought the war with us.
No, it wasn't stupid. It allowed Nicholson to move in and show everybody that the Marine Corps knew how to do this shit. It was Marina Sand. It was a brilliant fucking move. If you like Marine Corps stuff. But because you locked it home and down. Granted,
but what does that have to do with favor. What does that have to do with winning though?
That's what I mean.
It was all bullshit.
Nicholson knew he wasn't going to win shit.
Timmy was right.
But it was a chance to fight a division. Come on, man. How many times do you get a chance to fight a division?
See, that's your right.
And that's exactly what it is, bro.
But you were right, though, about saying we had too many. It's like two opposite problems. Afghanistan, too many, too soon. too many, and then Iraq, not enough. Because Iraq's different, whole different animal. Hundreds of thousands of armed men, you know, who were, you know, looking for their salary from the government, all of a sudden they're out of work. And why? Because the United States basically did like a blitzkrieg on Saddam in 2003, you know, in what was it, 5 weeks. They're like, hey, fuck that. We're still here. We're going to fight. You know, and so hey, there, man, you go. Read, then you got Ramadi and Fallujah and all that shit, you know?
Iraq scared the shit. Iraq was a scary place for me, and I was only in Baghdad. But you guys got to remember, in 2005, I could drive anywhere in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Without
yes,
a weapon, without a concern. I could go in. I went into Gore. I went everywhere doing food assessments. And everywhere I went, it was like a hero came in. Everybody was happy. There's one. There's an American. He's not a Russian. He's good. So it wasn't like we had to. Yes. We trained the Taliban. And most of that shit, like those punks that were in that Lone Survivor, the guy that Andy McManus was going after, that guy was just a fucking small-time hoodlum. He wasn't yeah. Taliban. He wasn't right. shit. He was just
yeah,
a
he's
punk.
A,
and that's
he's
all
a
there was.
Tree thief. He's a tree thief.
That's right.
You know,
Yeah. And that, so then we could have done it if we had thought it through, but we did these
I don't,
two
I
guys
mean,
in
do what? Do what, though, Timmy? That's what I guess I keep coming to. So,
oh,
first of all,
we went there,
right, to whack the Taliban who gave safe haven to Al-Qaeda and to kill bin Laden. Why right. would we stay beyond that?
Yeah.
What I was doing in reestablishing the irrigation systems and putting things back the way they were, and mind you know,
hey, fuck that. Who gives a fuck about that? What does that have to do with America's national interest and going in and whacking Al-Qaeda? And then how did we get to fucking trying to create an Afghan state? I mean,
that's it's an adventure for retired military guys. Come on, man. Shit was fun.
All right.
But you're right.
You know what?
There you go.
Yeah.
That's about all it was. Yeah, it was a great adventure. But what I'm saying is, we could have gotten to some level of being able to take care of themselves and gotten the hell out of there. But you would have needed about one-tenth of the people.
Why would you even attempt that? I mean, so to me, you look at them and say, look, we're going to be floating, right, in the Persian Gulf, and we have places that we can come get you. If you stack two bricks on top of each other that piss us off, trust us. We have more ordnance than you even can fathom, okay? But we don't give a shit about your shithole country, okay?
Don't
do this again, because when you go in there, it's a fool's errand.
No, you're absolutely right. I don't argue that at all. I've written that in a blog 10 years ago, that those exact words. All I'm saying is once we went in, once we decided to stumble our way into this thing, we screwed the entire thing up, and I don't believe we're capable of unraveling that mess and figuring out what we could have done or what we should do in the future in similar circumstances, other than not going in there in the first place. And I'm a strong believer.
Well, as Jeff said earlier, that's a subject for a different show. But to me, yeah. right, when you look at these things, right, and this to me comes back to the general officers of our nation. They're the only ones that can prevent this shit. Because the politicians are liars. It's in their DNA. And so the only unique people that have served and sworn an oath are those general officers that can prevent this and say, sorry, ain't having it. You'll get my resignation, and you'll see me on the news tomorrow, and I'm going to call everybody the fuck out. Right, and I'm gonna do it for as long as anybody will listen to me. I will go on TV, and I will fucking get into every motherfucking one of you. And then I'm gonna take the information I can get from everybody who's ever served on me that believes what I say, and I'm gonna jam that up your ass every day on TV. That's my moral obligation to this country.
They're worried about that.
Didn't Eleanor Roosevelt herself
hold on, Timmy. Go ahead, Jeff. Say what you were gonna say.
I'm sorry, Jeff.
A couple of years ago, they were trying to pass bills that would penalize retired officers from speaking out about current political decisions regarding military, and it didn't go anywhere. Right. You know, because by that time, Obamacare had managed to knock Nancy Pelosi and her people out of the. They were not liking that. I think it was around the same time Joe McChrystal and, you know, all those guys were saying, "Vice President, bite me," and shit like that, you know.
But if you're talking about public policy, and Mattis has made this point here since he resigned, if he's talking about things that are policy, and he's not commenting on people, look, I agree with this policy, and let me give you another reason. Let me show you current events. You're talking policy, and to me, that's absolutely, I mean, their obligation to the nation if it's not going right. And that's what I see is a huge problem for the nation, and they've got to do that, man. They've got to do that. Yeah. If not, nobody else will.
But I want to say this, though, about you know, General Mattis and all that. Another guy who's exactly like that is General Keane, the guy who's on,
Fox.
He doesn't have any, you know, he's just a retired guy, but he's very, he's made himself a little corral that he don't get out of. And it's a good one, you know. Right. He'll say anything. He'll say, "I don't agree with the president on this. I don't agree with the, you know, the general on that." But, you know, it's not in a way that would be objectionable.
No. He's not an asshole about it. And so, to me, this is what I get to about the nation in general, right? The concept of articulate discourse is lost on the nation. You know,
yes.
We can't do it anymore. To sit and listen to somebody who disagrees with you, right, and allow them to have their say, and then in an articulate way, rip their ass apart, right, and be able to sit there and do that is the way that we ought to be able to do it. But you can't do that anymore. And, I mean, it's the most frustrating thing, because Jack Keane is a great example of it. He's an articulate guy who seems to me tells the truth about most things.
And yeah, He was Tradoc. He came to Quantico, and I was talking to him about I was the director of IOC. And we talked for about a half hour right there in the TBS CEO's conference room. And, man, he is a good dude. Yeah, I didn't ask him shit. He asked me, like Timmy was saying about General Allen,
right,
you know, about the way, you know, how everything from class size to, you know, how much, you know, field, you know, good stuff. I'm just saying, I don't want to waste time praising, you know, him, but I really admire.
No, he's a great. I agree with you. He's a great example of what our general officers ought to be. And like I said, to me, you know, the state of politics is so disgusting, right? To me, what General Keane is a great example of is this concept of articulate dissent, and it just needs to be a big part of what general officers do. Because let me just tell you. I mean, I think we all live with the things that we've seen, the young people whose lives that have been lost, the other people that have experienced stuff, come home and taken their own lives, and the tremendous cost that war has. And so if the nation has to go to war, then the nation ought to go to war, right? In a violent, forceful way, in a relentless way. But if there's reasons that we shouldn't go to war, then people gotta stand up and be counted. And it just for young guys like us, when we were young, we grew up in the shadow of World War II, and we believed in what our nation fought for, right? And then all of that, a lot of that came into question about Vietnam. And after Vietnam, right, I remember the Vietnam guys were so proud of Desert Shield, Desert Storm. It had been done right. This is the lessons of Vietnam, to do it right, right? To give them a mission, to give them the tools, and then the politicians to back away from it. And then it's like in the wars that I've been around and participated in, you know, we've completely, you know, it's like we recreated Vietnam, which is a moral failing, as well as, in my opinion, a strategic failing in terms of vision. And so I think it makes one have a very, very heavy heart relative to this incredible experiment in democracy. And I would hope that we would have been better on the backside of Vietnam.
Hey, Matt, I got one observation on that.
And that is, did not Eleanor Roosevelt say that that every general and politician she ever met in every country was the identical man, the same person? I don't know how true that is, but that is something that I hear thrown about an awful lot as we talk about these things. I've not noticed it from the politicians I've met. But if we think, if you think it's reasonable to expect the general officer selection system to change, I don't think that's going to happen. I think what you need to develop is like a German general staff type of organization of smart guys, of big strategic guys who are walled off from competing for rank and whatnot, but used as wise guys. I'm thinking like the Bruce Goodmanson, Donald Vandegrift, mission command set, right? I think that might be viable. But the kind of generals, I don't think the generals are going to change. Every once in a while you get good ones. On the average, they're guys who made it to the top of a system, and they're system guys.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I just don't have confidence in our ability to do that. I see it being perverted. I see it not causing more problems than it solves. Even though it's a good idea, it's the guy, everything counts on the quality of guy, and that's what's the hard part. You know, the that's the hard part of it, the quality. And then you kind of spoke a little about the Germans. The worst fucking atrocities ever committed by these guys, and most of them I think were good guys who just were saying to themselves, I don't have the right to, I can do more from the inside with this guy, Hitler, than just quitting.
But I can from an end of a rope.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, if a guy just resigned, he let him go. I mean, and most of the guys he fired, he didn't kill, at least not at first. Some of those guys became part of the conspiracy against them.
Right.
But a lot of guys, they just, like the guy that Bill Lind loved so much, that guy made it through the war, even though he got let go by Hitler, or Balk, I think it was. But he'd always talk about this guy, and he always, when you'd be telling him why you had to send trucks back to get more ammo, he'd come up with some stupid General Balkism, you know, when you're in this TA-16, you know. But, yeah, it's like the whole republic turns, and these guys said this, you know, Monroe and Madison, Jefferson and Adams, and especially George Washington. The whole thing depends on, you know, the quality of the man. That's why they're religious in their own ways, you know, because bottom line, nothing works if no kind of system works, if unless there's some integrity in the people who are running it. And usually that's why people stress, you know, religion and stuff, because if you at least follow half of it, you know, that's what they try. They try and answer that one fundamental question. There's no, I don't care how great your system is, I don't care how great your constitution is, if the people are immoral who are enforcing it, it's just not going to work.
Right. All right.
There's no way to really get there, you know.
Final comments, Timmy. Final comment. Afghan papers through the light of Vietnam, through the light of Desert Storm, and the light of Afghanistan and Iraq.
My final comments on this whole thing is my fear about this is that my confidence in our institutions continues to erode rapidly to the point of no return. I don't see anything outside of a gigantic black swan event introducing systematic change the way we would need to rectify things and avoid doing the same thing in the future. I just don't see it.
Jeff, final thought?
Well, no, I agree with what he says, but here's the thing. I don't know if we got the grit to where this cataclysmic event that forces us to get our shit together would work anymore. I mean, what would be more cataclysmic than 9/11?
Yeah,
look at how both the conflicts that resulted from that end in not a defeat necessarily by the enemy, but we couldn't get our own acts together to do this. So, and plus, I feel bad about the stuff Timmy brought up about the Korangal and Bargamatal.
I'll be mad all night just thinking about that. But, very good discussion. And the main conundrum of military services, you know, when is the right thing to do not concomitant with the beneficial thing to do for the individual?
Right.
And how do you know that? And how do you make sure that we have people who, when they come to that, have the intestinal fortitude to go the right way?
Yeah, you know what? I agree. I mean, and I've said what you just said, Jeff, which is, so what's it going to take for us to reform ourselves? And you know, is it going to take, you know, the two of the tallest buildings in your country to be destroyed on national TV and thousands of your citizens killed? Oh, wait, we've already done that.
Yeah.
And we you know, digested it and continued to move. And so normally a nation will not reform itself, you know, until it is ultimately destroyed or defeated. And then somebody else will dictate the terms of your reformation to you, and then you'll see how that works. And as a German officer told me, yeah, that's not the best thing in the world, just to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And, yeah, no kidding. I went to talk to him at Fort Knox when I was a captain there, and he said, yeah, I asked him about the veterans organizations and, you know, just the proud lineage that the Wehrmacht had and that all that destroyed, right? I mean, all associated, you know, the German army, right? You know, broadly labeled the Nazi army, right? And you cannot embrace that in public anymore, even though the Wehrmacht had this proud, proud heritage and, you know, in military history, you know, before the National Socialists showed up. It didn't matter anymore. And so I asked him about that. And he said, well, you know, we still have our veterans organizations, but we have to be very careful. He said, and you know what? It's what happens when you lose a war.
Yeah.
You don't write the history and you don't write your future. And he said, it's bad business. It's bad business. Yeah. And let me tell you, I mean, honestly, maybe the moral lesson comes out of, you know, the moral failure of the German, you know, German general officers not to oppose Adolf Hitler, you know, at the start and say, you know what, I can't do this.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do this. So anyway, but it's a very, very important conversation. And I would think it'd be especially disillusioning and disappointing to guys like Tim's dad, who, you know, thought we had learned these lessons coming out of Vietnam and all the years they tried to teach us these lessons. And then to watch this stuff and shake your head and say, well, I guess we didn't learn these lessons. And now the Afghan papers come out and we find out that the politicians and other people weren't telling us the truth. Well, no shit, Sherlock. So, anyway. All right, with that said, boys, I appreciate the conversation as always. This is a long one. Thank you very much for all your time, and have a great week.
All right, Mac, you too, buddy.
All right. There you have it. More of Auburn Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.